Welcome to Writer's Voices with Monica and Caroline. I'm your host, Monica Hadley, and my mother, who's usually with us, isn't here today, but she will be back next week. We have a really interesting book. We always say that, I know, but this one, this one's a little different than most of the books we've had on Writer's Voices. The author is Mallory O'Meara. The title of the book is The Lady from the Black Lagoon. Mallory is an author, screenwriter, and genre film producer, and we'll pretty quickly get into what genre that is. Every week, she co-hosts the literary podcast Reading Glasses, and whether it's for the screen or the page, Mallory seeks creative projects imbued with the weird. She lives in Los Angeles with her partner and their collection of books and cats. The Lady from the Black Lagoon is her first book. And you can find out more about her on MalloryO'Meara.com. Welcome to Writer's Voices, Mallory, and I hope I'm saying your name right.
It's Mallory O'Meara, like bear or pear, and thank you so much for having me.
Of course. So The Lady from the Black Lagoon, Hollywood Monsters and the Lost Legacy of Millicent Patrick. Tell us how you came to write a book about a lost figure of Hollywood.
Well, she's been my hero for a very long time, and just like with all passion projects, and I did it because I wanted to find out about her, and there wasn't, as you'll hear in the reading that I do later, you know, there was no information about her. No one even knew if she was still alive. She had done this incredible thing in cinematic history, and no one knew anything about her. And I personally was so desperate to know what happened to her and her story that I had to find her.
And what initially, you grew up really liking this movie, The Creature from the Black Lagoon, right?
Yes.
Yeah. And can you remember the first time you watched the movie?
I can. And I'm going to, in the section of the book I'm going to read, I actually talk all about that.
Okay,
but I've been a monster nerd. Yeah,
sure. Why don't we just go right into that so that we can set the stage, so to speak. We usually read later in the show, but I think it would be good to get that introduction. So.
Great.
All right.
Let me know when to start.
Okay. Anytime, whenever you're ready.
In 1954, Millicent Patrick was an artist working for the world-renowned special effects shop at Universal Studios in California, the movie company famous for its monsters. Dracula, the Mummy, the Wolfman, and Frankenstein's monster had all leaped from the studio there onto the silver screen and eventually into the pantheon of film legends. That year, Universal was gearing up to unleash their latest horror creation upon the world, Creature from the Black Lagoon, and Millicent Patrick had just made history by designing it. No woman had ever designed a monster for a major motion picture before. Universal sent Millicent on a press tour across the country to promote the film. During the month she was away, a storm of resentment and jealousy raged back at the studio. The head of the makeup shop, a man named Bud Westmore, wanted the recognition Millicent was getting. Even though he received sole on-screen credit for the creature, he couldn't stand seeing Millicent in the spotlight while he stayed behind at Universal. By the time she returned to Hollywood, she no longer had a job. He pulled her from the film project she had already started working on and refused to hire her for future work. After that, Millicent never designed another monster. She never designed anything for film ever again. Her name faded into obscurity while the creature went on to become one of the most iconic movie creations of all time. On-screen credits in the 1950s were not as comprehensive as they are today. Her name does not appear anywhere in the film. Her contribution to cinematic history soon sank into a black lagoon of its own. The only people who remembered her were dedicated monster fans. Even they were in the dark as to where she went, what happened to her. That's where I come in. Until I started writing this book, the previous few paragraphs were all I or any of my horror film colleagues knew about Millicent Patrick. She is, at the time that I write this in 2018, still the only woman to have designed an iconic movie monster. Her rise, fall, and disappearance behind the scenes in Hollywood is the type of story films are made up, the type of story that needs to be told. This book started as a straightforward biography, the fascinating story of a fascinating person. But the more people I told about the project, the more I was asked why I was doing it. She was some woman who designed a monster for an old black and white movie. Why was that important? It was a good question to think about as I began to spend all my savings and all my spare time investigating what happened to this woman who I didn't know and wasn't related to. Why was I doing this? Why did it matter so much? When I first heard Millicent's story, my heart lurched with a terribly familiar ache. Hearing about a career beset by sexism, I could easily put myself in her shoes. I have the same pair. Every woman in film has them. They're standard issue and they're uncomfortable. Almost every day of my life as a filmmaker, I faced the same kind of infuriating, misogynistic garbage that Millicent faced in 1954. I didn't have to imagine what it felt like for her because I constantly feel it myself. So many women share this experience, women in every profession. We're ignored, sexually harassed, talked down to, plagiarized, and insulted in and out of the workplace. It's worse if you're a woman of color, a queer woman, a disabled woman, a trans woman, and worse still if you're a combination of any of these. I don't know a single woman working in my field or any creative field or any field at all who cannot relate to Millicent Patrick. It's not just her story, it's mine too. This toxic environment made it difficult to uncover much of Millicent's story. The sad truth is that many of the male collectors and historians I spoke to who had pictures or information about her were only interested because she was gorgeous, not because of her artistic talent. Some openly scoffed at the project and doubted her contribution to film history, but I never doubted Millicent. From the very first time I saw a picture of her, I knew she was exceptional. I was 17 years old when I found out about Millicent Patrick. I had just finished watching Creature from the Black Lagoon for the first time. Like millions of viewers before me, I was completely entranced. The film is a masterpiece. Over 60 years have passed since it was released, and it's still stunning. The story about a group of archaeologists who travel to South America to investigate the mysterious fossil of a fishman hybrid is compelling. For an old monster movie, it holds up. The cast is a pleasure to watch, with Lee Julie Adams lighting up the screen. As with all great monster movies, though, the true star is the creature himself. He is still one of the best designed and recognizable movie monsters in Hollywood history. The pairing of grace and primal power as he moves through the murky depths of the lagoon is astounding. You can't tear your eyes away from the horror and beauty of his longing as he swims beneath the heroine. The creature is absolute movie magic. Like all the best magic tricks, I needed to know how it was done. This is a normal thing for me. I see a great movie, look up everything about it online, and learn about all the people and processes involved in creating it. That's just what nerds do. But this time was different. All of the well-known special effects artists are men. The Wolfman, Frankenstein's monster, Dracula, King Kong, Godzilla, the artists who created all of them were male. Even the most devoted monster geek, which at 17, I already was, would have a hard time naming a woman in the field. This didn't seem strange to me. It was status quo. All of my monster-making heroes, Rick Baker, Tom Savini, Dick Smith, Jack Pierce, were guys. I had never seen myself reflected in the world of horror filmmaking. The possibility of it never crossed my mind. So I sat at my computer and read about Creature from the Black Lagoon. I happily stuffed new movie facts into my brain. Directed by notable 1950s science fiction director Jack Arnold, shot in 3D, inspired by Beauty and the Beast, cool, cool, cool. I scrolled down and studied the black and white behind the scenes photos. Then there she was, a beautiful statuesque woman leaning over the creature with a paintbrush. Millicent Patrick, animator and creature designer, the photo caption said. She worked on the monster suit with an easy confidence and a broad smile. This woman would have turned heads in any room she walked in, but standing on a film set, working on amazing special effects, she was galvanizing to me. She clearly didn't fetch coffee for anyone. She wasn't someone's assistant. She wasn't being helplessly carried away in the arms of the monster. She was creating it. Looking at this picture was like being struck by lightning. It was the first time in my life I had ever seen a picture of a woman like that. Millicent was holding a door open for me that I never realized I had considered closed. Come on, she said. We belong here too. I accepted her invitation. I make monster movies for a living. I produce them. I write them. Over the years, I searched for information, for anything that could tell me more about her. For all of my adult life and film career, Millicent Patrick has been a guiding light, a silent friend, a beacon reminding me that I belonged. But while Millicent opened the door to horror filmmaking for me, the door to her own story was closed. Information on her life was scarce and often contradictory. Some claim that she didn't design the creature at all. As I worked my way into the business, I thought of all the girls in the world, girls who love monsters, girls who love film. These girls are sitting on the sidelines, not content to watch, but filled with a frustrated desire for momentum and creation. All these girls are potential artists, designers, and filmmakers. It's so difficult to be something if you cannot envision it, to see no way in. To see the world that you love populated exclusively with those who are not like you is devastating. I wanted to whisper in all those thousands and thousands of ears that yes, you belong. Yes, you can do it. Look, look at this woman. She did it, and she did it back in the 1950s. Seeing Millicent Patrick work on the creature blasted open my mind, and I wanted to amplify that force and immortalize it.
Thank you, Mallory. That's from the introduction of The Lady from the Black Lagoon, Hollywood Monsters, and the Lost Legacy of Millicent Patrick. Okay, so the reason in the introduction that I said this book is different than most is that it's hard to put in a box. Yes, it's a biography. It's also an investigative report. It's kind of an expose, in a sense, and it's also a memoir. So when you started writing, did you realize what you'd gotten yourself into?
I didn't. I really thought this book was going to be a straightforward biography of Millicent Patrick. And I started listening to a lot of biographies. I'm a big audiobook person and reading a lot of biographies in print to prepare for it. And I had listened to this 18 and a half hour long incredible biography of my favorite writer, Shirley Jackson. It's a book called A Rather Haunted Life by Ruth Franklin. And it's incredible. But at the end of the 18 hours, you know everything about Shirley Jackson that you could possibly ever want to know. And I realized that I couldn't do that with Millicent Patrick, because the reason why I cared about 18 hours of Shirley Jackson's life is because I love her and I'm obsessed with her and she's my favorite author. Nobody knew who Millicent Patrick was, and I really needed to give them a reason to care about her. And I knew that the reason people needed to care about Millicent Patrick is because what happened to her in the 1950s is still happening today. And I know that because it still happens to me. So I started putting some of my own stories in there and taking readers along for the ride to try to find what happened to her, because what better way to illustrate the devastating effects of a sexist choice, you know, 50, 60 years ago than showing how difficult it was to unearth her legacy after that. Mm-hmm. So it sort of morphed into what it is now, which is sort of a Julie and Julia situation for monsters.
Oh, that's great. That's great. So, from the very beginning, you know, you kind of start with her. You're moving around in time a bit, because you're talking about in the book, you're talking about trying to find the information and where you go to find the information. And what I'm curious about is, as you're telling the story of her, which is fairly chronological in the way that you actually tell the facts about Millicent, but you probably weren't learning those things in a chronological order, were you?
No, but I did try. So when I started working on the book, I made a big chart that just said birth on one side and death on the other. Mm-hmm. And I tried to fill in the pieces as best I can. But I started with the creature stuff. But in Millicent's life, that doesn't really happen until and she's middle aged. So it was a sort of interesting. It was like, you know, when you build a puzzle, you start with the edges and the corners and you work mm-hmm. your way in. That's sort of what writing this book was like.
And were you writing it and research while you were researching it? Because the story of the research is really part of the fascinating part of the book, is, you know, how you actually were able to find this information. So were you already writing it while you were doing that, or did you like find as much as you could and then sit down and start writing?
I did a year's worth of research before I started writing. Just because I needed to know, it took me a year to make sure that I could find enough information about her to even write a book. And so after I got a good hold on it for about a year, then I started working on the parts of her life that I found all the information for already.
And then once you were writing, were there other pieces that fell into place afterwards?
Yes, because I started writing, and then I got my literary agent, and then we finally sold it. And then through the process of continuing writing, there were a few pieces that were missing that I was trying to find, and I got them.
So what was like the biggest breakthrough for you? Or do you not, we don't want to give away any spoilers, so
I don't want to spoil it. I did find one big breakthrough that broke the entire project open and was possibly the most important find for me. That was
I'm pretty sure I
about a
know what it is, and I won't
yes.
give it away. But
And that was about 6 months in.
okay. So you had a lot of information by the time you sat down to write.
Yes, I wanted to. I didn't want to start writing the book until I knew that I could find her life.
Right. One of the reasons it was so hard to find this information, besides the fact that women's contributions were poo-pooed and set aside, was that she kept changing her name.
Yes, Millicent Patrick went under seven different names over the course of her life, which made it a nightmare to track any information about her down. And by the end of the project, when I would ever go to a database or an archive, it would take me seven times as long because I would have to put in all of the names.
And when did you first find out, like, about the first alternate name?
It was pretty early on. I was trying to find the beginning part of her life, and I was looking in the Los Angeles Times archives, and I had found an interview with her from the late 80s, where she went under Millicent Patrick Trent, and the Trent part was what was the first my first clue. It was my first unlocking, because there was a married name that she had after she had worked at Universal, and once I got the Trent, then I could that unlocked a bunch of things for me.
When you wrote about her early life, there was a lot of information that you found about her parents, and you went clear back to even before she was born with them. And of course, one of the most, so she had an interesting childhood for that time. It wasn't just, grow up. She didn't grow up in the suburb with the white picket fence.
No, Millicent Patrick grew up on a place called Hearst Castle, which is in Southern California, and it was the summer estate of a man named William Randolph Hearst, which listeners might know as the man who inspired the film Citizen Kane. He was really America's first media mogul, and he had this opulent, massive estate in the middle of nowhere in the Southern California coast. And Millicent's father was a man named Camille Rossi, and he was the superintendent of construction there for 10 years. So Millicent grew up on this opulent, magnificent estate where, this is the kind of place where Winston Churchill and Charlie Chaplin would go to hang out. It was pretty over the top.
And yet her parents were very conservative.
They were. Both of her parents were, and they weren't approving of her starting to go towards the path of the arts.
That's interesting because you'd almost think because they had a lot of exposure to the wide world that they would have wanted that for their children too, and yet that didn't seem to be the case. Even before they moved to the Hearst estate, they had a pretty varied living situation, moved around a lot, different countries, different states. Do you think that was common for that time period?
It definitely wasn't common for that time period. So because Millicent's father was a construction engineer, he had worked in Mexico and South America. So he had been a lot of different places and brought his family with him. And that amount of traveling back in the 20s and the early 1900s was very, very rare, especially with a big family. So Millicent Patrick got a certainly a unique childhood.
Now, was it hard to find much information about her family? Because, as you know, I don't think this is really a spoiler to say that she was estranged from them for most of her life. So did that make it harder to find that information?
It did, especially because she didn't speak about them in interviews very often. So there wasn't a lot of
Right,
the tiny
right.
information that I started out with. There wasn't a lot of biographical information, and just also because her parents were born in the late 1800s. It was there's no Facebook back then, so it was a lot of archive digging to find out information about them.
Well, I thought it was really interesting that you told so much of the story about the Hearst Castle and the building of it, and her, not you know, certainly including her father's involvement, but also there were a couple of influential women.
Yes, there's a lot of cool, big, powerful, strong female personalities at Hearst Castle. And part of the reason I include a lot of that in the book is that it was very, very, that time period was very influential on Millicent. And after you grow up in a place like that, where else can you go besides Hollywood? So I had to put that in there to sort of see the what Millicent as a child was marinating in that brought her to where she ended up.
So tell us a little bit about her father's boss at the Hearst Castle.
So Julia Morgan is an incredibly influential and important architect in California history. She designed almost 800 different buildings over the course of her life in California, and she worked very closely with William Randolph Hearst, and she was the architect for Hearst Castle and quite a few other buildings that he commissioned from her. And she was a genius. She was an incredibly work-focused, brilliant architect who worked out of San Francisco and hired Camille Rossi to be her superintendent of construction and worked very closely with him over the course of those 10 years.
How did he deal with having a woman boss in that time?
Not well, not well at all. And that dynamic was also something that was very influential on Millicent to Millicent's detriment. But Camille Rossi chafed quite a bit at having to answer to a woman and did everything in his power to go around her and to disobey her. And that's ultimately the reason why the Rossi family, Rossi is Millicent Patrick's real last name. That's why they left, because William Randolph Hearst had to fire him because Julia Morgan got to the point where she said, it's him or me.
Mm. And luckily, he chose correctly. No.
Yes.
He chose the woman.
He did. He did.
Now, you said Millicent was born Mildred Rossi. And where did she pick up the name Millicent?
So she actually named herself after William Randolph Hearst's wife, Millicent Hearst, a woman that she admired very greatly. And she was Mildred Rossi for a long time until her early 20s when she started modeling and got out of her previous career. And she just stuck with the name Millicent for the rest of her life.
You're listening to Writers' Voices with Monica and Caroline, and our guest today is Mallory O'Meara, author of The Lady from the Black Lagoon. She is not herself the Lady from the Black Lagoon. And this is a book about Hollywood monsters and the lost legacy of Millicent Patrick. Do you feel like through all this that you really got to know Millicent?
I do. I truly do. There's a one big breakthrough, which I, again, will not spoil for your listeners, that made me, for a long time, I felt like I had a great hold on Millicent as a artist and all the things that she did in her career. But it was one big breakthrough that made me realize that I didn't know her as well as a person and allowed me to get to know her in that way. And now I do. I feel like I'm the world's external hard drive for Millicent Patrick.
Oh, I bet you wish you could have known her when she was alive.
More than anything.
Yeah. Is her work still influential?
Oh, absolutely. So many things that she worked on. I mean, Guillermo del Toro said we wouldn't have the Oscar-winning film The Shape of Water without Millicent Patrick. Just her work on The Creature alone has been incredibly influential on the world of film and horror and monsters and science fiction. You know, she designed the monster that was in Universal's very first science fiction film. You know, she's such an important trailblazer, not just for women, but for artists.
Now, in the introduction, you read that that her boss at Universal was jealous and basically cut her out completely. How did he come to hire her in the first place?
So he hired Millicent Patrick while she was working as a background actress. Millicent, while still being an artist, what she would do is she was working on these big studio lots, you know, Paramount, Warner Brothers, Universal, And one of her favorite things to do during downtime on set of, and if you're an actor, you know there's quite a lot of that, was she would sketch these portraits of her co-stars, these very, very talented, beautiful portraits. And she was doing that one day at the Universal lot while she was in the makeup chair, and Bud Westmore, who was the head of the Universal makeup shop, saw these incredible pieces of art and wanted to hire her for work that we would call now being a concept artist, essentially.
And at first, he wasn't jealous of her talent?
No, at first, I mean, he was fine with it. He asked her to come work for him. It wasn't until the press tour where she was going to start getting media attention that things went south for her in that regard.
Do you think she was the first woman to work in this position in a major movie theater?
She was.
Now, she claimed to have had been another first previously. Can you tell us a little bit about that?
Yes, Millicent Patrick was one of the first female animators at Disney. It's impossible to know if she was the very first, because animation, the production of animated films doesn't really lend itself to a strict linear timeline. But she was one of the first. Her first job out of college was working at Disney as an artist.
Was that unusual?
Not for where she worked. So back then, during hand-drawn animation was really coming up, before things are like they are now with computers, is that there was a huge department called the Ink and Paint Department. And that department took the animators' drawings of the animations and inked and painted them onto these little things called cells. And they're clear pieces of celluloid acetate. And that's what actually gets photographed with the movie camera. And the ink and paint department doing this very detailed, incredible work was entirely staffed by women.
I think that's so fascinating that it's, you know, there's so many other areas where the women are really doing the hard work, but they don't get any of the credit.
Yes, there was this idea that because the inking and painting was so detail oriented and tedious that they equated it to sewing or some other domestic task instead of really the incredible artistic skill that was needed. So it was considered women's work and women did it. And it was no men were allowed. It was just an entirely female department. So it wasn't unusual for a woman to get hired there. And that's where she started.
It's, you know, there's so many areas where other creative areas that are like that. For example, in cooking, you know, the chef was always male for many, many years. And, you know, women did most of the cooking in the world, but the chefs got all the glory. And what's another example like that? Oh, like sewing. You mentioned sewing. You know, seamstresses were generally very, very poorly paid. And yet the designers, which originally were mostly male, you know, were superstars. And so it feels similar to that.
Yeah, there's countless examples in countless industries. It's a very common issue. It's something that still happens today. But luckily, you know, Millicent, it was Millicent's way in.
Now, how did she get out of the ink and paint department?
She got hired to start working in animation. Her path was that there was a new movie coming out that they were developing called Fantasia, and that was a very groundbreaking film, and they needed a special effects department to do some very specialty artistic work on the film that Disney wanted to sort of break ground on. And Millicent Patrick, along with another woman named Marcia James, was hired to do those special effects.
Why do you think they turned to women to do something that was so groundbreaking?
Well, you couldn't deny their talent. You know, Millicent really, really had an incredible skill for conveying a lot of emotion and a lot of movement in a very small amount of lines. And it was perfect for this film. It was perfect for what was needed. And Marcia James was the same way. They were both incredibly talented women. And Disney, at least from a gender standpoint, was a great person to work for back then and was very open to have women coming to work for him.
Now, so Disney had a lot of women employees and it's still a minority. Has that changed over the years? Are there more women
What's
and
funny is that there were more women working at Disney and animation in the 1940s than there are at most animation companies today.
wow. That's sad.
It's very sad. It's very, again, that's part of the reason why I wanted to tell Millicent's story so much, is because it's still so relevant and so reflective of what we're all going through in this day and age.
You're listening to Writers' Voices with Monica and Caroline, and our guest today is Mallory O'Meara, author of The Lady from the Black Lagoon. So, Mallory, you mentioned, I think, in the intro that you read that The Creature from the Black Lagoon was a 3D movie. That surprised me. I thought 3D was a more modern invention. How long has it been around?
Well, that was during the 1950s, was the advent of it, because this was a very interesting time during film, because one, we were finally, first for the very first time, studios were competing with a new form of entertainment that was television, and so it, we were. This was the very start of trying to draw viewers out of their homes and into the movie theater. So this is when we start to see a lot of gimmick things start up. You know, ways to things that you could only get in a movie theater. And also at the same time, this was the very first time where the studios were catering to a new audience, which was teenagers. You know, we had the suburbs for the first time. We had teenagers who had, if they came from an affluent family, they would have pocket money. They were bored. They needed to be entertained. So having things like three-dimensional films and or gimmicks in some way really behooved a studio to get butts in the seats.
Now, were movies being made then mostly color or black and white?
This is also an interesting time period because this was the changeover. This was when movies were starting to be shot in color, even though it was a lot more expensive, but you're still seeing a lot of black and white films. So this was in the early 1950s.
I found it interesting that when you laid out like the choices for the producers of The Creature was you shoot standard black and white, 3D black and white, standard color, or 3D color, and in each case you're going up in price. And so what did they settle on for the creature?
So they sort of went middle of the road for Creature. They did decide to do it in 3D, but they ultimately decided not to do it in color. So it was a black and white 3D movie.
Do you think that being black and white adds to its impact in a way?
I think it definitely helped out the monster. It's a lot easier to hide things when you are in black and white, not having to do it in color. I think that is part of the charm of it, is that we can project a little bit more imagination onto it because we don't know what color he is.
Now, the monster, the creature, he went through a few transformations during it, as they were preparing to make this movie. What was he
Yes.
originally envisioned as?
So special effects were and continue to be a very strange gray area in the film world, because some people don't know if it's is it a costume, is it a prop, or is it a makeup, is it a special effect. So the producer, William Allen, originally gave the creation of the monster suit to the prop department, who made something that is affectionately known by creature fans as the Guppy, because he looks just sort of like a sad fish. He doesn't look like a scary monster. And William Allen wanted that, though. He wanted a creature that would elicit a lot of empathy. He wanted the creature to look very human-like. But because it was a prop department and not a makeup department creating him, he looked silly and it wasn't quite right. And it wasn't a full suit. The entire suit was made out of like a full body spandex onesie with a mask on it, and it just didn't cut it.
And is this when Millicent stepped in?
Yes, this is when the studio heads realized that they needed a full suit. They needed something much more elaborate, and that's when the makeup studio was tapped in to create the suit, and Millicent was tasked with designing it.
Now, she worked in makeup, and did she just do kind of regular types of makeup too, of normal looking people, or was it all unusual makeup that she was asked to do?
No, she actually started out in beauty makeup, designing facial hair and makeup for just like dramas, period pieces. That's where she began. It was only after a few films of doing straight beauty makeup and facial hair that she was asked to design the monster for Universal Science first science fiction film, which was It Came from Outer Space. So she started in beauty.
Now, originally, did stars do their own makeup?
They did. And it was because it came from a stage tradition where stage actresses and stage actors would do their own makeup. When it translated to film, people kept doing that. And one of the greatest actors and makeup artists of all time was famous for that, was Lon Chaney. And it was Bud Westmore, who is Millicent Patrick's boss at the Universal Monster Shop. It was his father, a man named George Westmore, who came up with the idea of a makeup department. Because the problem is on camera, if you're doing multiple takes and multiple shoots, if an actor is doing their own makeup, it's not going to be consistent from scene to scene and shoot to shoot. So having somebody on staff to oversee all of this and to quality control and to do all the makeup, that was invented by George Westmore.
Now, again, I would expect that inconsistency wouldn't be quite as noticeable in black and white, but certainly would be in color.
Yes.
Yeah. So I found it fascinating, you got into the story of the Westmores. There was a lot going on there, wasn't it? And are they still in Hollywood? Is this family still a power in Hollywood?
Not like they were. There isn't a descendant, Michael Westmore, who is still an incredible makeup artist, still does a lot of work in the field. But the Westmores were a makeup dynasty back in the 30s and 40s and 50s. There was George Westmore, who invented the idea of a makeup department. He had five sons, and every single son went into the business. And there was a period of time where they were all working at major studios at the makeup department. So it truly was like a dynasty in lipstick.
And were these brothers all supportive of one another?
They were not. It was, I would not be surprised to see some sort of Game of Thrones-esque TV show based on the Westmore family, because they were deeply competitive with each other. They were very jealous. They were very petty. They liked to party. They liked to drink. They liked to gamble. They were very big personalities, and they were always vying for better jobs and more money and more prestige.
Were they all good at makeup?
They were incredible. There really is a reason why the dynasty was founded. They were very, very, they came up with so many, if you've ever taken a quiz in a magazine that tells you what makeup you should use for your facial shape, mm-hmm. The Westmores came up with that idea. They all co-owned a salon on Sunset Boulevard in Los Angeles called the House of Westmore, which was a very, very famous, very big salon back in its day. And it was this, they set a lot of trends, and they were very, very iconic for beauty makeup.
Wow. So Millicent had, not such good luck with Bud. Did she have good luck in her personal relationships with men?
She did not. She had a very tumultuous relationship history that is filled with a lot of tragedy, a lot of big personalities. Millicent Patrick would have been worth writing a book about alone, just if she had only done Creature from the Black Lagoon. But as I started researching her life, I found out so many other huge stories that she intersected with, that so many over-the-top bombastic parts of her life, and her relationships were one of them. And I just sort of couldn't believe that there was this much story in one person.
Do you feel like this story, that the story of Millicent Patrick, gives you a really good overview of old Hollywood?
Yes, it absolutely does. If you are, you can read this book if you are not interested in monster movies or horror at all. The monster movie part of Millicent's life was actually a pretty small portion of it, but the old Hollywood and Hollywood glamour and, behind the scenes lives of actors and filmmakers was a big part, was a much bigger part of her life and a bigger part of her story.
Well, how did Millicent make a living after she got blackballed from doing makeup?
I don't want to spoil that for the readers.
Okay. Okay. Well, let's talk a little bit about your writing process. So you mentioned that you did a year of research and then you sat down to write and you had your timeline. And then when, as you were writing, did you write from beginning to end?
I did write the book chronologically.
Okay. And was this something you were like squeezing in between making movies, or did you set aside
Yes.
some? Oh, wow. So when did you squeeze it in? Was it?
I'm a night writer. I'm definitely
Ah.
a nocturnal writer. I can only really get creative as soon as the sun goes down. So I do work on my film stuff during the day. I do my podcast in the afternoon, and then at night I write.
Well, let's talk about your podcast, Reading Glasses. Tell us a little bit about that.
So Reading Glasses is a weekly show that I do with my friend, director and writer Bria Grant. And it's a book show where we don't talk about books. We talk about reading. So instead of reviewing books, we talk about how to get a book back from someone who borrowed it. What's the best library app to use? What's the best way to support authors? How do you get stickers off the back of books without damaging them? So it doesn't matter if you are a romance reader or a comic book reader or you're an ebook reader or a print reader, or you like horror books or westerns. It doesn't matter how you read or what you read. You can listen to Reading Glasses. The show is really focused on helping you read better and improving your reading life.
Now, do you have guests on the show?
We do about 3 out of every 4 episodes, we have authors on, but we also focus on getting book adjacent people on. We interview librarians and booksellers and publicists and people who help make books more accessible to disabled readers. We try to get a lot of people from all over the bookish world to chime in about these questions and issues.
Now, I'm on your website for Reading Glasses, which is maximumfun.org/shows/reading-glasses. But I'm sure if you Google Reading Glasses, you'll eventually get there. And it looks like you do talk about a lot of books on each show because you have all the books that are mentioned on that show. So you get authors on, you're not talking about their books in particular, but just
Well,
about.
every at the top of every interview, we always ask people what they're reading and have them tell us about their book that just came out
Okay.
or whatever, however close it is, and then we get into the main topic.
And how do you come up with topics? Because you must be very creative, because I think I would run out of topics.
Oh, we're actually outlined for another year. The show's been going for almost 2 years. And when, I mean, for readers, there's an endless amount, at least for us, of things to talk about. We get a lot of great listener questions with reader dilemmas, and sometimes we'll have episodes all about that. We'll do deep dives into particular genres. But a lot of it is centered just around reading lives. Like, we've had episodes like, how do you comport yourself at an author signing? How do you make book friends? How do you find a book club? How do you join an online book club? What's good book etiquette? How do you give a good book gift? You know, there's so many readers have such a unique fingerprint when it comes to their reading lives and how they read and their own unique problems. You know, we test out a lot of book technology, the best e-readers, best book lights to read by at night, bookmarks, book stamps. You know, there's so much book culture that isn't necessarily about reviewing books that we have sort of an endless amount of things to talk about.
Now, you always have a long list of books mentioned. Give me an idea of like how books come into it, like why you would mention a certain book in the context of whatever you're talking about. I know that's kind of a tough thing to do, but.
Oh, I think as readers, you know, we are always mentioning books. It's sort of always offhanded, and that's kind of how it happens in the show,
Okay.
where we'll be talking about it, and I'm like, oh, well, when I read this book, and then and we say when we mention, when you look at all the books that are mentioned in an episode, it quite literally is that it's a mention. We're not reviewing them. We're not going in depth. We're just saying, hey, oh, I read, oh, we're talking about Talking Bears. Well, I read this great book, and then we'll keep talking.
Oh, cool. And of course, one of the books mentioned recently was The Lady from the Black Lagoon. Do you talk about your writing process at all on there?
I do keep our listeners updated on both of me and Bria's. We're both writers and filmmakers. You know, we keep our listeners updated on the projects that we're doing. And, you know, as a big reader myself, I gleaned a lot of really interesting insight through the publishing process that I thought was really fun to share with our listeners. Just interesting things that readers don't know about the way things go on behind the scenes. And I was really excited to be able to share that stuff.
Well, let's talk a little bit about that. And if you've just tuned in, this is Writer's Voices, and we're speaking with Mallory O'Meara, author of The Lady from the Black Lagoon. Now, your book was published by Hanover Square Press, which is one of the biggies. Was that kind of a slam dunk for you, or did you have a traditional author travail story to go with that?
Oh, it was really tough to sell Lady from the Black Lagoon. We got rejected by 40 to 50 different publishers. It was a slog, but we found the right editor who I adore, Peter Joseph at Hanover, and we had an incredible time working together. And but it wasn't, you know, there was a period of time where it was definitely not a slam dunk.
Wow. Wow. Well, 40 to 50 isn't the record for people that I've interviewed. So just so you know.
Oh, that's
we had some authors from the Chicken Soup series, and the initial Chicken Soup books were rejected like close to 100 times, I think.
Wow.
And then they
became a phenomenon. Yeah, it happens.
Yeah, yeah. And they ended up with a small press. They didn't end up with a major publisher. What's the most unexpected thing that you learned about publishing?
It's how truly little control the author has over a lot of things. Mm. You know, I am currently on book tour, and a lot of people don't understand that I'm really not the one who's behind that. I have a whole publicity team who sets that stuff up. So, you know, when I was a reader, I would be like, oh, why isn't this author going to this city? And I didn't realize, and I realize now that it's not in the author's control.
Yeah. And so where are you speaking from right now?
Oh, I'm home in Los Angeles, but tomorrow I leave for my first Bay Area date. I'm going to be at the Bay Area Book Festival this weekend, the 4th and the 5th of May.
Well, so this will be your first one, this is just your first Bay Area one?
It's my first Bay Area one. I've been on tour since March 5th.
Oh my goodness. Okay, so you're an old hand by now.
Yeah, I've been to quite a few cities all over the country.
Do you like the book tour aspect?
I love speaking. I love public speaking. I love meeting fans and readers. It's a lot of fun.
Some authors are very internal. You know, aren't good public speakers, and so that can be a pretty painful part of the job for them. But it's an important part. It seems like people really want to connect with authors.
Yes, I think that is a part of the process that is also surprising that people don't tell you about when you're working on becoming a professionally published author, is that there is a huge public speaking, social engagement, promotional aspect that no one really teaches you how to do. And you just have to figure it out. But it is very important. It helps you reach more readers. It helps you find your audience. And that is so key for an author. And it's a very integral part of it.
Now, did you have any input on the jacket cover for your book?
I did. I did. I had, and that's actually pretty unusual. Most authors don't get a lot of input, if they get any input at all. But I had a big amount of input on the Lady from the Black Lagoon cover. The illustrator is my tattoo artist and book illustrator, a man named Matt Buck, who is an incredible, incredible artist. And the cover designer, Aaron Craig, knocked it out of the park.
Now, is this the same design as your tattoo?
No, it is
no.
not.
Okay.
It is. It's, my. I wanted to keep my tattoo for myself.
Oh. When you, I found it amusing when you were doing research that you felt sometimes you needed to cover up the tattoo. that you had of Millicent because it made you appear a little too stalky, or you were afraid it would.
Well, yes. Well, also, I mean, as a heavily tattooed person, there are a lot of scenarios where I do cover up a lot of my tattoos because there's a lot of places in the country and there's a lot of people who have a lot of negative reactions to tattooed people, especially tattooed women. So I'm very strategic about showing them off.
Now, are most of your tattoos monster related?
I do have quite a few monster-related tattoos. I'm very heavily tattooed. I have at least five monster tattoos. Six.
So how did it feel when you had the finished book in your hand?
It was incredibly overwhelming, the knowledge that people would finally know who Millicent Patrick was, that I carried her banner here, that I got to the point where I had a tangible object that I could refer to, I could send people to find out information about her, is the greatest honor of my life.
And how long did the process take from when you decided to write this book till it published?
I think my agent told me the day it came out, I think it was 1,200 days.
Oh, my. Oh, my. But you got an agent pretty early in the process. How did that work?
It took me about a year to get my agent, Brady McReynolds. Because I had known him before, we actually talked about the project, which helped kick it off for me. And he said, look, you know, if you can get a proposal together, I would love to take a look at it. And it took me a year. And then I sent it to him and he said, yes, let's do it. And we've been working together ever since.
Do you think you would have moved forward with the project without the encouragement of somebody who wasn't in the business like that?
I don't know. It's hard to say because my best friend, Lauren Panapinto, is the creative director of Orbit Books. So I do have it's hard to extract my life from literary people. I have friends with a lot of authors and that encouragement was already around. And I also, you know, I am a writer. I'm a screenwriter too. So I think it might have happened, but I don't know if it would have happened as quickly.
Is it at all challenging to go between screenwriting and book writing, you know, nonfiction writing?
Not particularly, not for me. They're very, very different types of writing, and I like switching off between the two for that reason because they are so different.
Do you find one to be more or less creative than the other, or are they both equally creative?
For me, they're equally creative. You know, screenwriting is clearly a very creative pursuit, but writing the nonfiction that is compelling and interesting to somebody is also very a creative process.
One of the interesting differences to me is that when you're writing a book, it really is all about you in getting it out there. Yes, you have to find a publisher, but getting the book completed. And then you find a publisher. Writing a screenplay, you not only have to find someone to produce the screenplay, but then there's this entire collaborative process after you're done writing, although I don't really know, maybe you're not done writing, maybe there's a lot of script changes that happen after that, but you have a sort of completed project, and then there's all these other steps before it can really see the light of day. Whereas with a book, Not quite so much.
Yeah, the screenwriting and filmmaking is definitely far, far more collaborative than novel writing or prose writing is. And that's actually why a lot of people are attracted to it and why I have a lot of fun with it. I love collaborating. I love being a filmmaker. I love that part of the process. I think it is just so much fun. But it is very different from novel writing, and you do trade off. You have a lot of control when you're writing a book, whether it's nonfiction or fiction, whereas in screenwriting and in filmmaking, you're sharing control with a lot of people. So, but then you get a bunch of people to bounce ideas off of and to help you. Whereas you got to write that book all by yourself.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. Do you, now I completely forgot what I was going to ask you. Well, we're almost out of time. We're getting close to the end. What's some advice that you would give to somebody who has an idea for a book that maybe is a little different, like this was, this was something that maybe took a little bit of convincing people that yes, this is something that the world needs a book about. What advice would you give to somebody else in that position?
I want listeners to know that. So I wrote Lady from the Black Lagoon before Me Too happened and before Shape of Water happened. And there was a lot of people who were not interested in Millicent's story. There was a lot of people who, just didn't seem to care about it, but I really cared about her. And, if you are writing something that means something to you, you can be guaranteed that it's going to mean something to somebody else.
Oh, that's very good advice. I'm going to have to write that one down. So your timing actually worked out pretty well. Like you said, you wrote this before Me Too, you wrote this before The Shape of Water, and yet both of those, Shape of Water certainly brought more attention to the creature, and Me Too brought more attention to what women have to deal with in Hollywood. In regards to The Shape of Water, how close was that aquatic man to the creature from the Black Lagoon? How similar are they?
They're similar, the asset from The Shape of Water is very heavily inspired by the original creature design, but it is very different in a lot of regards. They're both incredible designs. I got a great quote from my friend Mike Hill, who designed the asset for Guillermo del Toro and Shape of Water, and he's a huge Millicent fan, and that quote is in the book about his thoughts on her design. So it's they're different, but the creature is the asset from Shape of Water is sort of the next step from Creature from the Black Lagoon.
Have things changed a lot in monster movies since The Creature from the Black Lagoon?
They haven't changed as much as you'd think they would. I mean, from a practical standpoint, yes, things are in color. We have CGI. The process of filmmaking is very different. But things haven't improved as much. We still need more women making monster movies. We need more women designing monsters. So in that aspect of the industry, things are haven't changed quite as much.
And your film writing, are you writing monster films?
I am.
Can you tell us the names of any?
I not legally. Not.
Aha! Oh well, we'll just have to wait. But you will get credit, right?
Yes.
You'll make sure of that, and we'll be looking for that. Well, thank you so much for joining us today on Writers' Voices, Mallory.
Thank you so much for having me.
And I do want to tell our listeners that, like Mallory said, even if you have no interest in monster or horror movies, this is just a good story. And
Oh, thank you.
yeah, and there's so many aspects that you delve into in her life and Hollywood and the Hearst Castle and the making of movies and how they were made and that it's quite fascinating.
Oh, thank you so much.
Well, thank you for being with us, and see you all next week on Writers' Voices.
Thank you.